This is the Liberal Europe podcast by ELF, bringing liberal ideas into the political debate with Leszek Jezdzewski and Ricardo Silvestra.
Hello, everyone. As I said, this session is going to be in English, and so this is a very special edition of the Freedom Games panel. It's not the usual panel, don't be surprised. So it is called How to Make Liberalism Sexy. And I'm one of the co-hosts of the podcast, which I'm happy to share with my friend here. I am Leszek Jezdzewski, and this is Ricardo Silvestre.
Very good. The way he says Silvestre is getting better and better. Like tremendous. We are also the hosts of the Liberal Europe podcast that brings you this session. And this podcast is a European Liberal Forum project with the partnership of Liberté. We're very happy to share. And with the social liberal movement think tank from Portugal.
Yeah, you might be surprised why I'm doing this with American, but don't get fooled, he's actually Portuguese, so...
I'm very Portuguese again. The American comes from another way. And in fact, I don't know if Blasje is here. I don't think he is, but I've been trying to have a Freedom Games in Lisbon, so...
Yeah. I'm going to move to Lisbon as far as I have any serious offer, so yeah, please.
Very good. Very quickly about the podcast, it's a forum for open-handed discussions on European societal and economic questions, and we hope to provide our listeners the tools to be more active, more free, and more positive. And like Leszek is saying, we're co-hosts. He has a section where he goes into very, very interesting conversations. He's the brains of the operation.
Here's the looks. And here's the looks.
And from that, Leszek, to the people that don't know you, introduce yourself.
Yeah, so I know that there are a lot of people who might be here for the first time. So I'm editor-in-chief of Liberté. I'm vice president of the Liberté Foundation, which is organizing Freedom Games, and co-host of the Liberal Europe podcast. So I think that's enough. Ricardo, how about you?
As for myself, I am an author and political scientist, again, from Portugal, from Lisbon, and also I'm very interested in about the future of democracy, debate in democracy, and democracy in a digital era. So with the pleasantries out of the way, we're going to tell you what's in store for this session. So first, we're going to have Leszek talking with our guest, Sven Gerst. They're going to go a little more into the philosophical aspects of what is liberalism, and how can we define it. And then
it's going to be Ricardo, who is going to talk with Tamás Toplak from ELF and Zoltán Rajbuk from Republican Institute, and also the youngest MP from Poland, Aleksandra Kot. And they will go into very practical questions, so trying to convey a liberal message to make as appealing as possible.
But there is something different, and there is something more, and actually very excited to do it because we going to do something out of the box. After the first panel, we're going to do a game with the audience, with volunteers that we need to come here and to ask questions about the European Union and about Łódź and the Freedom Games. So this, please stay. And we also have, as a motivation,
there are prizes.
We have gifts for whoever volunteers, okay? And then we'll just randomly select people to come here and join us.
Right. So I think it's...
Let's call Sven. I will bring
Sven here, and let's roll. Whatever he wants. Okay. It's like Brezhnev asking, when can I take a piss in Warsaw? It's like, whatever he wants. So this is the first secretary. Right. All right. So, Sven, you are a philosopher from UK. You're based in London School of Economics, right?
I was at King's College London. I was
King's
before
College.
At the London School of Economics. There's a rivalry,
right.
So you're already tapping into the...
Yeah. You know. Sorry, but you are a liberal philosopher, and I think that's why we want to ask you this very first question. How ideology can be actually sexy?
It's a kind of question where I could go in all sorts of different directions, like what it would mean to be sexy. Like sexy is something like very physical. It's like desire, right? Like maternal, like animalic, and an idea cannot be that. But when we talk about an ideology that is appealing, not like sexy because that's like something physical, but appealing, then it can be if it gives a vision. And that's already kind of giving you the idea what might be wrong with liberalism in particular. But what are the ideologies that are appealing, that are sexy? They bring something new, and they bring something that is a big vision. Now, if I jump ahead a little bit already and portray that with liberalism, well, liberalism is the status quo. Does it really give us something new? Not so much, so therefore not so sexy. On the other side, does it give you a vision? And I think throughout the Freedom Games, you get a sense that everybody always says it's up for the individual. Everybody can create their own society. That's not very visionary. It's very true. It's not very visionary. So it's not very utopian. So what makes a sexy political theory, I would say, it's visionary. And it's kind of radically new that people have not heard before. And there you can already see why we brought that up in comparison to our vis-a-vis liberalism.
Right. So there were some ideologies that I think, that's a question to you, were sexy. Was fascism sexy, for example, at the beginning?
You corner me right there. But I evade the question about fascism and make it a little bit more.
Okay, make it about communism, maybe in 1920s. Was it sexy?
Sure, it's like
50s.
Communism. Hayek has, in his brilliant piece, Intellectuals and Socialism, he makes the fundamental point that I think is still underrated until today, that the appeal of socialism was that it is fundamentally utopian. And we see that in the way socialism is communicated is always in the utopian way. Like what happened in the Soviet Union, well, that was not real socialism because in theory we have the utopia how it might look like, right? How the real world turned out, well, that was not real socialism, right? And so the utopian ideal, the dream world, that was always communicated. That's something that we see in socialism, and that we don't have in other ideologies. You have it in fascism, certainly, that there is an end goal to a certain degree, and that like already comes with a lot of connotation uttering that word, but there's a dream world, a utopian standard that we can aspire to, a vision that is outlined. And again, like I just asked the audience, think about what is the vision of a political theory such as liberalism? What is the liberal utopia? Hayek very much asked that question in his essay, Intellectuals and Socialism. And he says, liberalism doesn't have an utopia. Maybe it should have. Or it shouldn't. I don't know. But that's something that I guess is on the table here.
What you just said brings me to the book which we published, but it's not the only reason why it's worth reading. It is Adam Gopnik's 1,000 Small Sanities. And I think it's a very appealing argument that that the liberalism is a bit like a rhino, right? It's not a unicorn. Unicorn is actually very strongly connected to which you would know if you would go to see our stable of unicorns, which is like the centerpiece of transportation points here in which. Well, you have to see it to believe that actually this really looks like a stable of unicorns, Stania Jednorożców, right? And so liberalism is not a unicorn, it's a rhino, because a unicorn might be slim, might be beautiful, might be slender, might be actually sexy. But it's only one thing by unicorn. This is wrong. It doesn't exist, right? And rhino might be massive, might be, you know, a bit slow in the head, you know, it gets angry, and it's not a really beautiful animal, but it's real. So do you think that Adam Gopnik is right and this is the appeal of liberalism? Or should we try to make liberalism more utopian and actually more unicornian?
I mean, first of all, I would resist the kind of analogy to the rhino that is slow in the head. Like, if
it was a provocation.
If liberalism is one thing not, then it is not slow in its head. It's the most robust intellectual tradition, and I think that to a certain degree, it's part of its detriment that it has such a canon of intellectual work behind it, right? So it's not really slow in its head. But coming back to the argument itself. I would rather stay with the analogy between not the rhino and the unicorn, but in the love language of like sexy versus not sexy, right? And I just ask maybe the audience, whoever is in a long-term partnership, like just reflect. Yeah, you can also like you can also raise your hand. Who is in a long
term? Define the long term. Define the long term. Okay, we have one, three, four. Right. Okay, more people.
just think whether you would use the word sexy to describe your partner. So I don't ask you to answer that question. Don't
of
worry.
Of course. Don't. I hope you are here, and of course, but Magda. Yeah.
Most likely we would not use the word sexy to describe our partner because we love our partners. And it's not just about sexiness, right? There's more to it. And what we have seen with political theories such as liberalism that are actual things that happen in the real world is that we don't have passionate desire, eros about liberalism. What we have for them is appreciation and love. And in an ideal case, and I think I will talk later why we might not have fallen out of love for liberalism, at least on a global stage. But that's maybe the right analogy to think about it. We have seen all shapes of liberalism and how it plays out in the real world, without makeup, with makeup on. We had our expectation towards liberalism, especially in the 90s and early 2000s. Now we see it when it's a bit worn down without makeup in day-to-day life, then it doesn't look so appealing anymore. So when it comes to, again, the sexiness topic and lovable, I think sexy is a theory that is not practiced out. It's an utopian, idealistic realm of ideas or set of values. But what liberalism is, for example, as a real-world political institution and political theory that is worked out and applied in the world, it is something that is like a long-term relationship that we have with the idea. And then we don't have to ask ourselves, is this sexy or not? But is it lovable or not? Hmm. And is it lovable? That really depends on where we are.
By no word, our task is to how to make liberalism sexy again. And if I take your analogy, which is actually quite dangerous, we're working on very thin ice here, is that, okay, so if you want to make your relationship sexy, perhaps you should change your partner or have a paramour. So is it possible with the liberalism?
No, I would not say you should make your partner sexy. Like if you claim
that your long-term partner is not sexy, mine might be yours.
I will not get into that trap. You can't bait me in there.
But I'm serious.
Robert Nozick talks very famously about love, and that love is not about the eros, the passionate dimension. That maybe is a little bit of a role in it, but it's about the common appreciation, the love, right?
Maybe you should explain that he's like a libertarian thinker, not like the writer of the romantic books, right? Obviously.
But I think he had a quite successful love life. But anyways, Robert Nozick says, like, okay, love is this particular concept that is not necessarily tied to sexiness. And I think, like, liberalism doesn't have to be sexy because liberalism has succeeded. People all over the world are more liberal than ever before. Maybe they don't label themselves liberals. Maybe they don't vote for liberal parties. But liberal is the dominant morality of our time. More people than ever are liberal. I would go as far as saying that in most of the countries that we are living in, people have as their dominant set of moral values, liberal values. They are not fundamentally Christian integralists, like they might be LARPing as Christians, but their day-to-day morality is very close to the values of personal freedom, acceptance of something like human rights, respect for fairness and reciprocity, democratic decision-making, and the like. So the day-to-day reality of most people is that they are liberal. So we are in a deep relationship with liberalism as human societies, so we don't need to make liberalism sexy. What we need to make it is that it stays in this relationship with people, because people are disappointed currently, and that's why we see the rise of illiberalism, because people are disappointed of this relationship that they have with this abstract political theory that is actually not abstract but played out in the real world.
Right. So how I guess what you're saying is actually we should not try to make liberalism sexy, but the world more liberal. But is success sexy? So you are saying, okay, actually it is liberalism, maybe not sexy as such, but it's successful. So maybe it's about power, a power of defining reality. Is it your point?
Again, sexy is not maybe the overall goal of global liberalism, but to stay on top of things. And the initial success that liberalism had in its young history, it's only 200 years old, until today, it maybe suffers from its own success. It has become intellectually dead to a certain degree. Academically, I always ask my colleagues and my students, what are some of the most relevant philosophical thinkers of liberalism since John Rawls?
I mean, still alive, you mean? Still alive.
Still alive.
Well, not, yeah. Yeah. Which names?
Yeah, I'm looking forward. Maybe you can provide me.
You have a podcast.
You invite people. You talk to people. What are the most interesting, relevant liberal thinkers that have pushed forward the political theory? We are still talking about John Stuart Mill, Adam Smith, John Rawls. That's kind of the last seminal points. Intellectually, it has been dead. Political leaders that consider themselves liberals and push it forward. A lot of people still refer to people such as Margaret Thatcher or like whatever, Ronald Reagan, whether we consider them liberals or not, up for a different debate. But like, where are the leaders of this particular movement? And I think we have stalled out as an intellectual and political tradition in the last couple of years because we were so successful. Kind of the Fukuyama story. Well, it's the end of history. The world will become more liberal eventually, and evidently, but then we don't have to put in the effort, like in a relationship. If we know we stay with our partners for the next couple of years, we don't put in the effort. I would certainly not do that, but people don't put the effort in. And that's what liberalism did. It doesn't put the effort in. And I think that's why we have panels on the topic of how to make us sexy again. But if you know a thing or two about relationships, when things are degrading, like putting up the new makeup doesn't help, you know? So you have to do some fundamental changes.
Yeah, God is dead, Marx is dead, and I myself think not quite well, right? That's what you're saying. Well, Jesus Christ is dead for a long time. It's still quite relevant, right? So maybe you don't need like reinventing the wheel every time now and then. Okay, but let's get adjust a little bit serious. I think there are, you being based in UK, right? So at least starting there and still being active intellectually. I think it's also quite visible at other universities. You don't really see the thousands of young liberals, you know, crowding and marching and discussing. You rather see that sort of like a new left, the post-colonial discourse, in economics as well, right? You've got this new economic theory. What makes the left, especially in this very radical radical version, so attractive for the young? Is it just that it is opposing the mainstream? Is it offering this utopian version of reality? Or do you think there's something more significant, something that is more close to that people really need, this sort of strong emotions and the strong convictions? And the liberalism is really boring. It's not offering them that.
Yeah, I think, of course, the first part is for sure that liberalism is the status quo, and nothing is more boring than the status quo, right? So that's, I talked about it. I think that's one part. The second part is, I think that identity plays a bigger and bigger role in contemporary society, and liberalism always struggles with the topic of identity. So if you look at the topics such as post-colonialism, critical theory, a lot of the stuff that Yasha Monk was talking about yesterday, these are questions of identity. And I think those are the issues that liberals have historically underrated. That's why Francis Fukuyama at one point then wrote a book on only identity, where he says, like, basically, yeah, we should put that on our radar. But at that point, it was already quite late in the process. So again, we are like catching up with a development that was going on. And I think liberals have a lot to say about the topic of identity, but they have completely missed that we have a new realignment in politics that is not about capitalism versus socialism anymore. That's kind of the boomer politics, like the boomer alignment of how we thought about the world. It's not the fundamental economic battle anymore. What we see in politics now, and that what excites young people, that what excites actually many people all around the world, is that we are in a moment of time where all of politics is on the issue of identity. Are we more cosmopolitan liberals for the open society, or are we more closed off? Identity based on, for example, ethnicity, race, gender, or whatever it is. And that's the other pole of that debate. And here people fall on different camps. And I'm not so pessimistic that most people are identitarians on both sides, either left identitarians or right identitarians against the liberals. Most young people are liberals by their status quo. They have been raised in a liberal framework and they are committed to liberal morality. But they are disappointed by liberals that we don't have much to say about the issues of migration or the issues of identity in a modern world where old cards of identity, such as religion, such as association, such as other things that are important, are not addressed by this particular theory.
And do you think they should be addressed, or do you think the way it's addressing, liberalism addressing those issues is just not very interesting or very relevant, or that we are trapped sort of between this new wave of populist right, which is very communitarian in a sense, or finding an enemy, a common enemy, like a Trump in politics. On the other hand, you've got this identitarian politics, which is all, you know, the whole issue of problem with the cancel culture, of sort of like this minority defining themselves, and not everyone is catching up. I think also liberals are not catching up, right, with many of those issues. And they're blackmailed by the left on one hand, and on the other hand, they try to oppose the right. And it seems they fail on both fronts, one politically and the other one ideologically.
Yeah, I think liberalism doesn't struggle to address it. I mean, as I said before, like when you can raise many criticisms of liberalism, but certainly not that the theory has like holes in it. I mean, it's a very robust intellectual canon. I think it's more sociologically that we don't engage with certain groups that we should be engaging with. I think I always take feminism as a core example here. Like, the early stages of feminism was determined by liberals, like Harriet Taylor Mill, Mary Wollstonecraft. These were feminists out of the liberal tradition, and they came out of it because one of the core values of liberalism is skepticism about power. And nowadays, when we look at feminist circles, there are very few classical liberals or liberals within them. It's not because we abandoned feminism as a cause. It's more sociologically, liberals were diving out of that discourse and then left it to the left in that case. And similarly, when it comes to issues such as post-colonialism or intersectionality, or all the topics that are on the table, what people at universities, and universities are kind of these experimental clusters where all the hip ideas are discussed before they like trickle down into mainstream, right? And that's where we are not present, but out of sociological reasons. We say, oh, like this is all stuff that we don't want to engage in, but we can. There are spaces where we can. Like there are injustices out of post-colonial nature that we could address from a liberal lens, where the dominant lens is maybe through rights violations or detraction of freedom rather than the dimension of a Foucauldian power, but we can address. We have the toolkit. Sociologically, we don't do it. And I think that's where I'm disappointed. And then we don't like develop a new cluster or new class of liberal thinkers that could address with that audience.
Oh, it's already getting romantic. But it's yeah. As you see.
Fitting the theme. Fitting
right.
The theme.
Well, but we can still hear each other and we can even see what's the topic of this discussion. And I can see the timer and it's only 3 minutes left for us. So maybe to close this, our conversation, well, I do hope that at some point we're going to see each other again. But and you don't fall asleep, especially. So if we can get the lights back, that would be great. But in the meantime, in this darkness, how do we make, how do we bring light, enlightenment? Thank you. Well, turn it on. Right, so how do we turn liberalism on?
Like that's, you say like you have 2 minutes and now tell me how to save liberalism from itself. I mean, and also that's way above my pay grade. I mean, you know, like, it's a difficult project. I think first of all, liberalism has to like recognize that it is the status quo. And maybe if there's one message that I hammered home in these last couple of minutes, it is really like, don't be not hopeful. Like, liberalism has succeeded. Like, it's one in most societies, the dominant morality.
So be hopeful, you mean?
No. Be respectful of what we achieved, okay? Liberalism is, as a way of life, something that has achieved a lot. Most people have nowadays liberalism as their most dominant political, like morality, I would say even, okay, as their way of life. They are liberals, okay? But in terms of the intellectual movement, we get counter clashes all the time, and we should be prepared for that or even be flattered by that. The rise of populism, the rise of geopolitics, these are two things that are distinctively illiberal. Viktor Orban's populism is called illiberal democracy. I mean, how much more flattering can you give to an ideology to say, we come with a counter ideology because you are the status quo. So now liberalism has to finally understand that for 200 years, it has been the progressive movement at the fringes and it has always fought for stuff. Now it has become more status quo. It is in a committed relationship with most human societies. And then we behave differently than when we are the aggressive person who wants to win people over. So we have to shift our tonality and adjust to that particular role. How to do all of that? That's a million-dollar question. But one of the things that we could do is to finally recognize that for ourselves that we have become lazy in our own relationship with the people and didn't put enough effort intellectually, politically. We didn't deliver properly, for example, politically, and that we need to do that better. And maybe just to close that off, what I mean with the delivery issue, in every relationship, at one point, you want to deliver to your partner. That becomes very physical now, but you want to deliver in that relationship. And liberalism has disappointed now because it was in the position to disappoint, because it was tried out, and we are still having it in many societies. But what we need to get better is at this delivery. And that's why we need something like state capacity discussions, where we say, what does it mean to be a good liberal politician? What does it mean to be a good liberal bureaucrat? What does it mean to be a good liberal think tank? And that's something that we haven't done in the last 30 or 40 years, I must say, because the innovation on that front is not up to par, I would say. And that caused a lot of the problems that we see in our relationship right now. Not in ours, but.
Right. So get out to the world, be a liberal, and make love. Thank you so much. Sven Gerst, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
You were listening to the Liberal Europe podcast by the European Liberal Forum. This podcast was co-financed by the European Parliament.